Okay. So in subsequent papers put out by the Pinchef Lab, when they obligingly cited our work, there would be a small error in the text of the citation. For instance, my last name would be misspelled, or the volume of the JBC in which the article appeared would be incorrect. And then a third time, I think it was the name of the postdoc that was working in Laura's lab who participated in the paper was misspelled. I'm not sure about the order or whatever it is, but there was three different mistakes in like three successive papers that came out of that. Now, if I wanted to jab somebody, because, I mean, if you get a paper that's in your field that you know that is related to something, the first thing you do is look to, we're all egotistical, we look to see if our papers are in the bibliography. And then there's nothing more disheartening to see your name has been misspelled. So it's a small little kick, but it certainly didn't help improve my feeling about the relationship between what our lab, or Laura's lab at that time, and the Pinchef lab. Now, interestingly, Laura, so I no longer work on Niemann-Pick C except in my mind, and Laura still is actively pursuing it, and she has a very, very good relationship with Peter Pinchef. Laura's been down there and given a couple seminars. She stayed at the Pinchef house. They played golf together out in Tucson. There's a national meeting for the Persegian Foundation. Whose family has this aberrant gene. So they have a meeting in Tucson every spring, and they go out there and they play golf together. I'm going this spring, and I look forward to playing golf with Peter. So all this now is, and whenever he emails her, he says, "Love, Peter." And so all this is behind us, but and thankfully so. But there was some competition there, but I guess we all saw the advantage of working together, although there hasn't been a whole lot of collaboration, but at least we communicate.
Is your name being spelled correctly?
Well, I haven't paid much attention to it, you know. I guess you only would monitor that if you felt that it possibly would be misspelled.
Well, have you ever brought it up?
No, I haven't, no. Yeah. Maybe she might have. I don't know. I'll have to ask her. It was bizarre. It's like three in a row. I'm not kidding.
Amazing. How wars are played out in science. Okay. Well, you had on your Pew application, at the time you were submitting your Pew application, you also, what funding were you working off of when you was starting up your own laboratory? And I know that you applied for NIH funding and I think an American Cancer Society grant, and how did then that work out?
Mm-hmm. So the funding that I was working off when I started up was just startup money from the department. But shortly thereafter, the project that I wrote, I wrote the same grant for to the NIH as well as the American Cancer Society, and it was a follow-up to the work I'd done as a graduate student in trying to characterize a novel isoprenylation, because those were, as I said, were hot topics of experimentation at that time, to study these modified proteins and how they went about or how they were formed. So the follow-up, the extension of that PhD work was put into an NIH grant and submitted, as well as an American Cancer Society grant submitted, and then also to a small local foundation here, General Cinema Foundation, was giving out awards to young investigators in the Boston area. So fortunately, it was funded by the General Cinema Corporation. So I think they've changed their names, called Harcourt, Harcourt. And that helped also, coupled with startup funds, to get me going. Neither the NIH nor the American Cancer Society funded that proposal. And I had advice from people at the American Cancer Society that they probably wouldn't ever fund it. It just wasn't what they were looking for. I resubmitted it to the NIH unsuccessfully again. after applying some more preliminary data, you know. And actually decided not to pursue, not to submit a third time. When I got a phone call one day from my, from Ed Bellion, my master's thesis mentor. And he had been serving on study sections for the National Science Foundation. And he and I had told him about, he had followed my work, and most recently this, my dissertation work. And he knew that I had submitted it to the NIH unsuccessfully twice. And he thought it was just the sort of thing that the NSF would be interested in keenly. And that and he had experience from serving on a study section that would review that, and that I should have submitted to the NSF. And so, you know, I didn't, that's exactly what I did. I didn't add any more new data and just more or less reformatted it to the NSF guidelines and submitted it. It was funded straight off, got all the money I wanted, and even the four-year time frame. So, you know, I guess this is just another example of, you know, hitting the right study section and attracting the best audience. So that was my first large government grant.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think NSF was more interested in it than anyone?
You know, I don't know. I think I have incorrectly, maybe, but I kind of have the impression that the NSF is interested in studying, does not maybe limit, it limits its funding to more applied and clinical type projects, and that they really just would fund anything that they thought was important, which includes a lot of basic, just raw knowledge. Whereas I think study sections and council want to have a little bit more assurance that information gleaned from proposals will have a sooner direct impact on, say, healthcare or treatment or the like. I don't know if that's right. That's just my perception. Right. And then clearly, this project kind of fell into the category of basic research. With the NSF, too, let me think. Well, the study section, you submit a grant, and there's a group of 15 people sitting around, two of whom read it thoroughly and provide the primary review, and then there'll be another two who have read it not as thoroughly, but more than just superficially, to provide sort of secondary review. Then everybody else is supposed to have read it to at least be aware of what's going on. But if you've got 150 proposals and only 15 people, then, you know, I think it's unrealistic to think that all 15 have read all 150. So it usually comes down to two or at the most four or five people to actually form an opinion and the score for that grant. In the NSF, there's the study section consists, I think, of, once again, X number of people. I don't know if it's 15, but let's say 15. And one of those is a primary reviewer. And then there is another primary reviewer who's outside the study section. And often that outside reviewer is someone who's been identified on the proposal. So I submitted three names of people that I thought would be competent reviewers. Now, I didn't submit Peter Pinchas' name. I submitted three people that I thought would give it, that who would be interested and who have encouraged me along the work that I had done towards this. So it's sort of like you've already...
Right, hmm? And get your name spelled right. Too.
Yeah. So, but I'm sure that... So then the NSF study section brings in the report from this outside reviewer and then listens to the inside reviewer and then comes up with a score. Now, I'm sure that they're aware that all the outside reviewers are not enemies of all the proposers. So they probably weigh all that in. But nevertheless, at least you've got someone who's going to help or who's going to reinforce the positive things you're saying, you know, about what's the potential here, or that I can do this, or that the proposer can do this, and what's going to come about. So it kind of helps reinforce the proposal, and maybe also add some other important insights that could make it a stronger proposal from their own background or their own experiments or something. Say, well, I know this to be true. I think this is important because we've done this other, and it's really neat. Whereas in the NIH, you know, you never can tell what you're going to get. So it's a different evaluation system, and maybe some grants get, in a relative sense, a more favorable review with this other sort of system compared to just a completely blind review by anonymous members.
And how did you react when and respond in terms of your research work when, you know, there was this gap of you got the Pew funding and mm-hmm. the work that you were going to do fell out and these other projects funding were pending?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what were you thinking then? How the Pew would react that you wouldn't be spending money on the project that you proposed, and how are you going to deal with this kind of gap?
Well, when you know, I realized that Joe and Mike had done my Pew grant, I wasn't on the...
very gracious about the whole thing.
Well, I wasn't going to send them the money. I figured they had enough money. They didn't need another $50,000 a year. But I was concerned about how I was going to address this issue with the Pew. But with discussions with other Pew fellows, I was fortunate in that there were actually two that came from our department here, and then there were a couple of others in the Boston area. They told me that the Pew is not so much concerned with seeing that a particular body of work is done, is performed based on the proposal that was submitted, like the NIH would be. They judged more the ability of the applicant to formulate a meaningful proposal, and that whether he's in a position to do that proposal or anything else he thinks about, and then once again, kind of in the same context of the Pew facilitating and fostering creative thinking and endeavor in their scholars and in other activities, that it wasn't a problem for them if I wanted to still take the money and do something else. They would be entirely supportive. But still, I had a lot of concern in writing that first year's progress report and thinking that, you know, they might raise some red flags. But there never has been any comment coming back from the Pew to indicate to me that they were displeased. Now, but one of the real issues or the real concern I'm still facing is that, so initially I had reservations about taking that money and doing, and because that project was done, then I said, well, what am I going to do with this money? And I was getting money from the NSF to do this other project, and then in the meantime I'd picked up I was getting money from the NSF to do this isoprenylation project, and at the same time I had got attracted to the study of another genetic disease that along with it came a subcontract on an NIH grant. So I was doing some experiments. My lab was growing or was producing, but it was being kind of funded through its own sources, and I didn't feel it appropriate to at that time put Pew money into stuff that was already being funded for something else. And I didn't have, and the other thing was that I didn't know anywhere else to spend the money. I had enough money. Well, I didn't have enough, but I mean, I had enough, but I just didn't think ahead to think, well, where could I spend more? The idea of spending money just for the sake of spending it doesn't sit well. It comes back to my mother. So I didn't spend a lot of the Pew money in the first couple of years, and I have a surplus that I'm still carrying. mainly because I didn't know where to spend it justifiably. Now, some people would say, well, that's a pretty enviable position. But it has kind of caused some problems. So, but in the meantime, I've been able to do other little projects or devise other little projects and become a little bit more freer in spending money on things that I used to think would be frivolous to devote the pew money to. For instance, I took on a postdoc, a real creative, a woman who was an MD, who was an MD PhD in our department, and she had finished the PhD part, but she had to wait 6 months to get back into the mainstream of medical school. And she had come to me with a really neat proposal that demonstrated her creativity. And I thought that this was a good this would be something that the Pew would certainly want to consider in spending money for. So I said, why not spend their money on this? And nothing really came of it, but you know, it was a good experience for this individual. And we learned a new technique that we still use in the lab. So even to this date, you know, I have this carry forward on the pew now that I think I'm going to be able to spend. But if I don't spend it all, I'm going to turn it back. But I think so. I guess the real problem that I faced with the Millennium Transporter is not so much getting sanctioned from the pew to do something else. It's just doing something with the money that was justifiable, and that's still a little bit of a problem.
Well, how yesterday you had mentioned that when you do things because you think that's what they want to hear, and that sometimes now we're living in an era where results need to meet the kind of work that was proposed in the original application.
And sometimes
that makes work boring.
Mm-hmm.
And how has getting money or making applications to these different kinds of federal and private granting agencies, how has that changed the kind of work, the science that you do, and the kind of science that you propose? I guess I should put it the other way, the science that you propose and then the science that you ultimately do when you do get the money and are working at the lab bench. You know, how does it affect if you're going to be applying to the NIH versus the NSF versus say American Cancer Society or the Pew Foundation or whatever? How does that affect what you say and then what you do?
Right. Well, I haven't really come up for renewal on NSF. Actually, I'll be writing that probably this fall. But I planned to, I planned to write it based on what I've done, which hasn't been entirely what I proposed to do. And I don't think that's going to be a problem. So I think, once again, the NSF, my perception of the NSF is that they're just interested in pursuing science in a more, maybe a more creative fashion. And especially, basic understanding and fundamental knowledge. So it's less important that it follows set guidelines that were set out in the original proposal. So I'll be kind of freelancing it there with the NSF. Now, the NIH, we're also this summer. So as a result of this little, initially started out as a subcontract, and now I'm a co-investigator on an NIH grant with Rod Bronson. And we're up for renewal, submitting this summer, and we've stuck to the specific aims pretty well on that. So, and I, because once again, it's my perception that their study sections go back and look to see what was written in the last proposal, what was proposed, and will determine if the money that was allocated to do those studies, the studies were actually done before they give out money for something else. Now, that may not apply to investigators at other levels in our profession, for instance, Joe and Mike. I mean, I think whatever they pose, they don't have to do the NIH grant. And they didn't for a long time. You know, there were, I mean, lots of laboratories are posing to do experiments for NIH grants that are all but done already. And kind of know what the, or 90% sure what the result or the discovery is. And that's not really too fair, is it? To say you're going to do something when it's more than half done. But that kind of guarantees, number one, if it's not submitted the first time, you've got a much stronger preliminary data because you can go back in and say, look, this is what I proposed to do, and this is the preliminary data I applied at that time, and now we've gotten some additional data that indeed demonstrates that we could do this, and this, and we've made a significant discovery. So it's hard for a study section to turn that down the second time. But, I mean, that's a common trick. I think everybody, myself, does it. But nevertheless, it certainly tells us that we need to stay along the guidelines that were as close to the guidelines as we proposed as possible, because that's what study sections reflect on. So with the NIH, then I'm going to stick pretty close to what we said we'd do, and I would probably continue to do that. With the NSF, I'll be a little bit more, I'm not sticking to that. Although I've done other experiments on the sides of my NIH grant that probably could, and I'll put them in there as interesting background data and maybe have small sections about how I kind of follow up on this apparently minute observation. It may have some importance down the road and may end up devoting a lot of time to it anyway. But the key thing, I think, is with NIH grants is to make clear proposals that try to answer specific questions and then do them. Now, about other private foundations, apart from the PI, I haven't applied to. Well, no, wait a minute. So I have an established investigatorship from the American Heart Association, which is just salary, and that required a proposal. And that's private. But, you know, that's, in all honesty, that's probably one thing that just got, I got that because of Joe and Mike. I mean, that American Heart Association's in Dallas. It's right over there on Greenville Avenue. Who's had more impact on heart disease than Brown and Goldstein the past 20 years? So if somebody came from their labs and applied for a grant from the American Heart Association and they wrote a letter of recommendation, I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't even read the proposal. So, So this was just it was a pretty minor, but it was more of an award than anything, sort of like the Pew for, wasn't based so much about, based on what you were proposing to do and actually doing it. They were just kind of awarding your potential and wanted to give some salary money. So I guess they do, or American Heart Association do offer grant and aids, which would be actual research, funding for research money. So that might gender up a more in-line proposal, you know, that you wanted to follow something along a specified route. And I'm not in a position to do that because I'm not doing so much with cholesterol metabolism now. Although I hear that the American Heart Association funds research outside the area of cardiovascular and atherosclerosis, whatever. So maybe in the future I will apply.
Okay, well, what does this mean for science then when, researchers need to create strategies for their work? Especially for somebody like you who seems to me to be most productive when you can do fragmented science.
Right.
And for two reasons, because sometimes it may be riskier, but the payoffs in terms of of advancing science can be also very big, but also just to keep the creative juices flowing in a researcher.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that the plus side is that you know, there'll be a steady stream of solid information, solid discoveries coming as a result of investigators following specific aims of their proposals as closely as possible. Because in when study sections give grants high scores, then it says that in addition to the investigator who's making the proposal, there's other experts in the field saying that there's going to be meaningful information come as a result of this experimental work. So they're concurring that it's going to be beneficial to not only, that it's going to be beneficial to our country, biotechnology eventually or whatever. And if you get more people who agree on that, then the likelihood of it happening are pretty good. And it's just up to the investigator to stick to that. Stick to the job at hand. But, you know, at the same time, so there'll be more predictable progress made in science. You know, you can almost say, we'll have the complete sequence of the human genome at some point in the predictable future. Whereas if we relied upon hopefully Lee Hood to develop a new sort of sequencing method or technology or machine that could sequence bases at 100 times faster, then it might come about sooner. But that might come about just because he got creative one day and went in his garage and started tinkering around and made this new machine that he couldn't get funded for if he wrote, because he didn't have the idea or it wasn't germinating enough in his mind to formulate into a concrete proposal. Right. So with creativity, that might come about in say, instead of the year 2010, in 25, but it's kind of guaranteed if enough people get on the write in proposals to develop maybe new technologies along with concrete ideas, that it's predictable that we could get it done in 2010, but we might not make that great leap to have it done in 25. So we'll lose the opportunity to, say, really speed up some discoveries or new information. But at the same time, it'll be a more even ride along the way instead of ups and downs. And then I guess it'd probably be more cost effective, because let's face it, there's probably for every dollar that's spent on... So if you had $10 and you were putting one on in an NIH designated track, then you'd probably get, say, $50 return for it. And if you had another $10 and you were putting it into the Pew sort of creative freelancing type science, then maybe only two of those dollars would ever pay back into decent experiments, and double that or multiply that by five and you get your $10 return. But there may be that investigator out there who takes that $10 and parlays it into, you know, $200 worth of needed technology and new ideas and information. But, I mean, there's a balance, sure. And I think that there's room for both. There should be room for both in our profession. And who does it is, you know, up to study sections and the like. It used to be that there were career development awards that the NIH gave out that were huge, long grants, like 7 years. Are you familiar with those?
Well, Well, I think.
Are they still giving those out?
That I don't know.
So that's like long-term stability, which would give people, the investigators, the opportunity to be more creative. But I think those have kind of waned. It'd be nice to see the NIH start doing that again. And they might, you know, if they've got, they talk about doubling the NIH budget in 5 years. Well, I doubt that that'll come about. Most people believe that, share that feeling too. But it could be that, you know, that we could have an increase at, say, you know, 50% over the next 5 years, of which half of that would go into just increasing the overall budget, and the other half would go into some kind of new awards. I think most of the investigators in our department are following their specific aims pretty close. If they want to deviate, then they usually get some sort of other seed money, lots of times from biotechnology or a small foundation grant, and then take the seed money and do some experiments, and it turn out to be positive and generate new data, either to incorporate it into their existing next NIH grant or maybe writing a new one. So their creativity is sort of financed by initially extra government funds.
Well, how do you see your own funding future?
Well, I have to write my renewal of NIH grant in September, but I'm pretty confident about it at this point, not September, in July. So we're starting this, once again, being a little bit more, taking on new direction, but this is expected. So as a result of my collaboration with Rod Bronson, we've identified these mutations in mice that cause the same phenotype as the human disease called NCL. And we spent most of the past starting out very small, you know, just with doing a few experiments and doing some biochemistry, and then finally writing a grant and being co-investigator and doing more biochemistry. That's all we've done, is just biochemistry to characterize the phenotype of this disease in mice. But knowing all along, it's the same, probably the same genes that are defective in human conditions. But it became clear to us that if we wanted to pick up the pace or study this at the higher level, that we needed to identify those genes. So that would mean cloning them. And if you don't know anything about the structure of the proteins that the genes make, or the levels of their expression, or if you have antibodies against it, then the only way to do that is by positional cloning, which is identifying genes just based on their localization in chromosomes. And that's something I know absolutely nothing about up until about 6 months ago. Fortunately, we attracted this this really bright Chinese postdoc who's had some experience reading a lot about positional cloning. And he looks like that he's read well, because he's progressing very well. But that's going to be the corner piece of this grant that we're submitting, is to positionally clone these, at least one of these mouse genes. It's easier to clone mouse genes positionally than it is human genes. And I think a study section will see that, and we are amassing a good bit of preliminary data that we hope will convince them that even though we've never done this before, with our collaborators, we have active collaborations with some human geneticists here in Boston, as well as some mouse cloners up at the Jackson Labs, that indeed these two guys, who one of them being a pathologist and a geneticist and the other more or less a biochemist and a molecular biologist, can indeed in their laboratory clone this mouse mutation. And then that will help a lot, because number one, it'll occur sooner than the human mutations, unless somebody knows something up there that we don't, about these human diseases that we don't. And then it'll help us really go forward in understanding this disease, to identify the defective genes. But we have to be convincing about that. So, I think that we have an advantage in that we would, Rod identified this mouse mutation up at Jackson Labs, and Jackson Labs has this policy that they don't give out those strains until they've been fully characterized in-house. So it's kind of a monopoly. So we have a leg up there that no one else has the opportunity for. And I think we're progressing pretty quickly on a good pace on identifying this gene, although it'll probably be about another year and a half or 2 years. So that, and then we've also got some good biochemical preliminary data that answers or addresses the specific aims that we proposed 3 years ago. So we, and there's significant data there and discoveries. So we hope that a study section will see that, okay, we accomplished the goals that we set out to 3 years ago, and in addition, we've taken on this new path, and that we can do it. So we're going to ask for a little bit more money and a little bit more time, and I think, you know, we'll stand a good chance. So with one large NIH grant, then you can do a lot of work. Yeah. And now next year at this time, I'll reapply for NSF, and I'm not so sure about that, how that's going to go. Well, that's just a little bit early to tell, I guess. Yeah. Well, I can see that I think that it's foolish for me to believe that I should operate with a lot of money, because I don't think that I can operate with a lot of people, just due to the philosophy I have about running labs. And running the lab. So I'm not anxious to go out and try to get 3 NIH grants. I think 2 federal grants would be plenty for me. That would be plenty. I guess the more money you have, then that usually means the more people you have, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. The more people you have, the more money you have to have. And then those two mores mean less time for investigators in the lab and more time for investigators attracting money and people, which is kind of like desk work. And I sorely lack desk work. It's not what I was trained to do. I don't do it best. I'm better at working in the lab. I'm still the best scientist in our lab. So when you stop and think about it, listen to this reasoning. So if I'm the best scientist in the lab, shouldn't I be working in the lab and the worst scientists be sitting at the desk? But it's the other way around, isn't it? Now, when I say I'm the best scientist, I mean, there's some people gaining on me. But that's just because I don't get in the lab anymore. I'm losing skills. If I got back in, then I'd be able to keep up with it, you know. But it's not all writing grants and reviewing papers and reviewing grants and things that are associated with the profession as a whole. I mean, there's a lot of pulls from the university, you know, apart from teaching. I mean, I'm sure that all Pew scholars begin to say the same. All right, I'll say the same thing as all the rest of them. I mean, the university expects a lot of us in terms of teaching and administration, which you can argue, and then I will, that it's unjustified, considering what we bring into the university in terms of not only indirect costs, which in essence runs the whole show here. I mean, every I have to really beg to have the university pay 15% of my salary. The university doesn't pay any of my technicians, any of my graduate students, or any of my postdocs. The university doesn't pay anything for my supplies. And in fact, they take money out to pay the light bill, which is, you know, to the tune of about 67%. Well, I don't think that I'm running 67% of the water and the lights and, you know, to pay for that. So, you know, why is it that I get saddled with committees? You know, teaching is okay. But you could easily argue that professional teachers do a better job, and they do. Other assignments associated with the university. Shouldn't there be other people along those lines? So those are pulling the best scientists away from the lab at the same time as attracting more money and better people and writing and reviewing, like, which are professional type of services. So that's annoying. You know, it's like, it's oftentimes, if I liken it to my old colloquial ways, that have you ever ridden horses much?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, so if you go horseback riding out, and after you've been riding for a while, and the horse kind of gets tired, it gets hungry, and it knows where the barn is, and it wants to turn and go to the barn, and you have to fight it if you want to go over the ridge to look at the sunset. So it's a lot easier to just to let the horse take you to the barn than it is to do something that you want to do. So when I'm sitting in my office, it's a lot easier just when the phone rings and somebody wants me to review a paper or serve on a committee or whatever. It's just a lot easier to say yes and follow that route. But it takes me away from, you know, what I want to do and what I think are really the important things to do. So you can really see how colleagues, you know, there's lots of colleagues in my department that don't even know where the laboratory is, facetiously. But they don't know where the pipettemans are in the laboratory to do an experiment with, or where what's in the drawers in the library, because they haven't been in there in years.
Right.
Because they've just been, and freely admit that they just went with the horse to the barn, because that's just the easiest thing to do at that time. But, you know, I don't think they had the same long exposure to laboratory practice and laboratory discovery that I did. And it's difficult to forget that. I mean, it's, you know, if you're a graduate student and struggling with a project, and then you're a postdoc and struggle a little bit more and become successful, then get into a faculty position and get funded, then it's,
yeah,
boy, I'm here. Thank God. But if you, you know, put a lot of effort in seeing the things that I have and experienced the discovery and the level that I have, then, you know, it's contagious. You're not ready to give it up. So, you know, I like probably other Pew scholars in front of me, that they would prefer to see more of their time spent in the laboratory. Although I, you know, at the last couple of meetings, I've talked to some of the other guys in my class, and they freely admit they don't work in a laboratory, and they don't think they ever will again. They'd like to, but they just don't see that it's possible. And getting back to what started, what brought this out was, I think the larger operation, laboratory people you have, the less likelihood it is for the investigator, the principal investigator, to experience lab work. So the opposite of that is, the smaller they have, the more likelihood it is. Well, I kind of lean in that direction.
Okay.